You're listening to the Straight to Video Podcast with Rob Lane.
All right, what is going on? And thanks for checking out my podcast, Straight to Video. It's Rob Lane here as always, and I hope you're doing great. On today's new show, I get to bring you a chat with rock and roll drumming legend Mel Gaynor. Mel's career has been constant since beginning in the 70s as a young 16-year-old touring the UK before becoming a highly in-demand session player. He would become best known as Simple Minds' longest-serving drummer, performing at the legendary Live Aid event in 1985 in Philadelphia. And for this particular podcast and our John Hughes obsession, he was also responsible for playing on the iconic track from The Breakfast Club, Don't You Forget About Me. Outside of Simple Minds, Mel has performed with endless music legends from Elton John, Robert Palmer, and Tina Turner, to name but a few. And he recently had a role in the brilliant rock mockumentary All Gold featuring the Kemp Brothers. Right now, though, Mel is focusing on his solo career with a brilliant new single, which is out now, called Run, and a full-length album, Come With Me, being released in May. This sees Mel not only behind the kit, but also on lead vocals too, and it's a real treat. As always, this Straight to Video podcast is proudly presented to you in association with Affinity Photo, an incredible piece of photo editing software, which I use all the time for graphic design. You can see it being used on the podcast episode artwork each week, and it's an extremely affordable alternative to other programs on the market. So please go and show them some support at affinity.serif.com. All right, let's dive in with today's episode. If you want to learn more about Mel's new music, everything can be found at melgaynor.com. But right now, please enjoy my straight-to-video chat with drumming powerhouse Mel Gaynor. Really enjoyed the new single Run, which is out now.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
There's like a real Americana feel to the track. Very organic, but it's got this like really cool pop sheen to it. I think it's got like a great crossover appeal, especially with how big country music's getting in the UK now.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been following the country music scene like in the last couple of months and it's getting huge.
It's crazy, man. There's been like the big C2C festival at the O2, I think there was.
That's right. Yeah. Well, country music's not like it was in the old days. You know, country music used to be, you know, fiddles, banjos, and you know, melancholy lyrics. Now it's kind of rocking, you know. And to be realistic, some of the best songs came from country songs.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that appeals right across the board. Pop, rock, heavy rock. You know, there's been some great songs which are derived from country songs.
Yeah, but I don't think your single Run, I don't think that's perhaps reflective of the album as a whole, though, from how I've heard you describe the rest of the album. Was it tough to choose a lead single to come out of the gate with?
Well, I think Run was a pretty obvious single to come out with because it's hooky, you know, and it's got a lot of elements that a lot of people like. The next single is going to be probably even hookier, probably a bit more pop. And that's called Little White Lies. So that's going to be coming out next month. But as far as Run, I'm quite proud of the way it sounds.
I believe the album, it was all written and actually recorded a few years ago, but delayed due to COVID as you weren't able to tour it. How was it revisiting it after that time and getting the chance to remix a record? Not many artists get that opportunity to hear things with fresh ears.
Well, yeah, it was a kind of weird one because the record was recorded and it sounded great at the time. And then, like you said, COVID hit. So we had to shelve everything, put everything on hold. And then I came around to thinking about last year, actually. I wonder how this is sounding again, you know. So I put all the tracks up. It sounded good, but it didn't sound that contemporary. So what I did is I got a guy called Michael Smith to go in and remix the album. And here we are now. You know, the album's out and, well, it will be coming out the 3rd of May. I'm quite proud of it.
And it's being released through Marquee Records. How did that whole collaboration come about?
Well, that collaboration came about through contacting Colin Peter a while ago and he heard some of the tracks. He liked them, but he wasn't sure at the time about putting it out. So I revisited him and said, you know, I'm going to remaster and remix the tracks. And he was elated with it. He loved it. And here we are. We signed with Marquee and the tracks are out.
Yourself being from London and growing up there, did the Marquee venue or venues, shall we say, did they feature heavily in your early career? Do you have any specific memories of playing there or going to see any bands?
Well, yeah. I mean, my oldest brother, he used to take me under his coat into Marquee And I used to watch all these great acts, probably acts that people had never heard of, but they were kind of known at the time. Jess Roden Band, Snafu, there's a band called Snafu. There was also a band called Steve Gibbons Band as well. They, you know, frequented the marquee, and I went down there as a kid and checked them out.
You never got busted from sneaking in under the coat?
No. It was pretty underhanded, let's say. And then, several years later, I get to play the marquee with Samson.
Oh, amazing, man. Which location was that of the marquee?
It was the one in Wardour Street.
Right.
So it was the original location, and it was a superb club. I mean, it was incredible.
You mentioned your older brother there. Is that the same one who you've worked with on the new album?
Yeah, basically, he co-wrote a couple of tracks on the album. Yeah, we collaborated, and we still collaborate on lots of material. And he's actually my live band as well.
Oh, superb, man. He's like been quite a successful musician, I believe.
Yes, he was with Stevie Wonder, Eddie Grant. He's with quite a few people, Tina Charles. He's, let's say, cut his teeth in music for a long time. And he's a professional musician.
Was he a working musician when you were at school? So you could kind of see music as an actual career as opposed to just a hobby.
Absolutely, yeah. He was the one who encouraged me to get into music and to be professional. Back and forth, we played together in various outfits. And it wasn't until I got this together, said, you got to come and play in the band. So he's in the band alongside my daughter as well.
Oh, wow. How cool is that? How was the live show at Water Rats?
That's right. Yeah, it was incredible. We took the roof off the place and it was fantastic. It really was a good evening. I don't think the people expected what we were about to deliver, because I think they probably thought it was kind of going to be Minds-ish, and it kind of is, but it's kind of on the heavy side as well.
I've seen some photographs. Are you singing and playing drums the whole time, or do you get the chance to come out front at any point?
Yeah, singing and playing drums all the time. There's only one track I've come out with. It's a kind of machine-led ballad. And that's called Wicked Game, cover of Chris Isaak one. Yeah, so we do that in a kind of ballad form, dark ballad form. So you'll hear that when you get the album.
What are the next plans for live stuff?
Planning a live tour, which is going to be coming up probably the end of June into July. We want to get from the north to the south, as it were. So we're planning to start off in Glasgow and end up in London. So we'll do all the territories in between that as well.
How were the nerves before that gig compared to other gigs?
I wasn't too nervous. I think it was apprehension rather than nerves, because I just wanted to see, how we'd go down and how the first couple of numbers would be received. It was well received. It was great.
And you're in the flow then. You're comfortable. You're away.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
You've been playing drums from like an incredibly early age. Rather than the kitchen pots and pans, you started on your mum's knitting needles at 6 and then got your professional drum kit around 11.
That's right, yeah.
Then right out of school, you went out on tour with the Flirtations. Do you recall how that even came about? Was it unusual for a 16-year-old boy to be heading out on tour?
It was kind of unusual, because I've been doing a lot of sessions before that and playing in pubs and such like. And there was a guy called Phil Bowdry who put my name forward to the Flirtations, and he's a big promoter now. He just put my name forward and then I just started to play from there. So I was pretty much professional from the day I left school.
What did your mates say? Did they even know? Like, where's Mel gone?
Not too many mates keep in touch now, but the mates I did have at the time, yeah, they were like shocked. They were like, they were doing painting, decorating or, plumbing. And they said, oh, you're going to go off and tour and play music? That's incredible. I was away for about 3 weeks, on the first jaunt. And it was really exciting.
Was there ever any doubt that drums would be your career from then on?
No, there's no doubt. When I first saw Buddy Rich and John Bonham on TV, that was it for me. That was going to be my life.
This is all like through an incredibly influential time for music, like the late 70s. You had disco, punk rock, a slew of rock bands coming up. Was you just this sponge for different musical styles, or did you have an all-out favourite?
I was just sponge for different styles. I mean, there wasn't one style that I said, okay, I wanted to definitely go with that style, or, it was eclectic. I just wanted to cover all bases. In fact, I started off playing a lot of jazz fusion, and then got into funk. Played with a lot of funk bands on the Brit funk scene as well.
One of the big bands from that time, I believe you saw it when you was working at the 100 Club, the Sex Pistols. Where in their career was they at that point? Did you know what to expect? Or like, who are these guys?
Yeah, it was their first gig at the 100 Club, and I was on the PA crew, and I was just kind of helping the guy out to stack the PA and everything. And it was just wild. That was just an incredible gig. The atmosphere of that gig was just wild. Unbelievable. Completely sold out.
Queue round the block.
Yeah, they were the new band of the era, as it were.
Was you slipping on spit when you were clearing the PA up at the end?
You know what? There was a lot of broken bottles, I can remember, and broken glasses, and, you know, it was quite shambolic, let's say.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about the marquee, you're playing in the band Samson, which I think was around like 1981. And Samson, as many will know, Bruce Dickinson's early band before he joined Maiden. And you played the Reading Festival in 1981. The whole set's on YouTube. I don't know if you've ever watched it.
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah.
Samson,
yeah.
Obviously a real hard rock band. Was that a style of music you enjoyed, or how did you approach that gig?
It was kind of weird because I auditioned for that band at Easy Hire, a place called Easy Hire, and the management at Easy Hire, you know, kind of pulled me in to play with them. And previously I was playing with the Nolan Sisters, you know, so you can imagine like these pretty five girls on stage and, you know, singing sweet harmonies and then going to, you know, a heavy metal band. And I was like, wow, this is unbelievable, you know, and the volume was just amazing. So I was kind of tiptoeing around with the Nolans, and all of a sudden I had to play really hard with Samson. So it was a kind of learning process, but it kind of worked. You know, I really enjoyed that time with Samson, really enjoyed it.
Do you remember much about the festival? I was looking at it. I think it was Bruce's final show, and you're on the bill with Gillan and Billy Squire.
That's right. Yeah, it was a great show, great day, very hot day. And I can remember, yeah, Bruce was on fire that day. And obviously, you know, they poached him from us.
You ever crossed paths with him since?
Yeah, a couple of times. We've got some mutual friends. And I've fucked up with him a couple of times. And he's always a gentleman. He's always a nice guy.
You're perhaps most well known as longtime drummer for Simple Minds, who you joined back in 82, after you'd already become a well-respected session musician. Back then, was you planning on joining any long-term bands? Because I think you initially just went in to do some session work.
I wasn't. I mean, it was just like a situation where I go in there, play a session and come out again. I ended up not coming out. I ended up staying.
Decades later.
Yeah, you know, I was still there. So, but it was great. It was a great experience just, you know, rocking up and playing the songs and being a part of history, really, with that album.
Absolutely. And through this podcast, it always comes up, I'm a huge fan of John Hughes movies, which you had a huge impact on with Simple Minds recording the song Don't You Forget About Me from The Breakfast Club. It's well documented the song was written by Keith Forsey, turned down by several big names, including Simple Minds, because you weren't interested in doing someone else's material, but totally put your stamp on it. Bigger guitars, I believe. The drums are huge, and the iconic la 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 la's at the end. But I think I saw you mention, was it recorded on the first ever digital desk? And it's a drum sound you're particularly proud of to this day.
That's right, yeah. It was the first digital desk in the country, and it was recorded at a place called Wembley Sound. Yeah, we just, you know, I just set the kit up as I normally do. And when I came in to listen, I just thought the drum sound was incredible. I mean, it was just cracking. One of the best sounds, I think, drum sounds that I've ever had, apart from probably Once Upon a Time, and that was with Bob Clearman. And that's, the second greatest sound I've ever had.
Was you apprehensive going in with, like, new technology?
I was just thinking it was a digital desk, and I wasn't sure that digital capability gave you enough oomph in the sound. But it sounded great. I mean, it was clean, it was, you know, precise, you know, a lot of guts in there as well.
How much time did you get to sort the arrangement for the song? Do you have any idea?
Not too long. We heard the arrangement. We were kind of fiddling about, and then decided to just take it. And we took it, and that was a take. So it's a one-take wonder.
Do you remember much about filming the video and how long that took? Because it's quite an impressive project.
I remember that. That was at Neighborhood House. It just took forever. I mean, we got in there like 5 o'clock in the morning. Didn't get out till probably 10 o'clock at night.
Which way did they do it? It starts where there's nothing in there, then it just gets busier and busier. Did they do it that way? Was it empty when you started and they filled it up?
Yes, it was. It was quickly empty when we started, yeah. But it was good fun. Good fun to do it.
Not only do you, like, truly make the song your own, but then it gets featured heavily in the film twice, beginning and end, so you can't really escape it. That thing's, like, embedded in your head. How was it seeing it on the big screen when you saw the premiere in London?
It was great. Really, real proud moment to see, you know, we got the top and tail and the full soundtrack. You know, up to this day, I think we played in Las Vegas, and there was a convention, like a Breakfast Club convention, and all the cast came and turned up to the gig that we played on, and that was a real moment.
Oh, incredible. When was that?
Must be about 10 years ago now.
Because I was looking through some clips. I watched the 2015 Billboard Awards clip. That, for me, shows the power and legacy of a song like that, because it keeps cutting to the crowd and everyone is singing along like it's the current number one and biggest song in the world right now.
Yeah, it was actually quite weird because I remember seeing in the audience people like J-Lo, Taylor Swift.
Ed Sheeran's there.
Ed Sheeran. And I was like, wow, you know, they're stomping to this music. It's really strange.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic clip. I mean, I know it's like a recent one, but it's like, wow, this really shows the legacy of this track. All these young people, like all different generations, just know it.
Absolutely.
Shortly after the success of the film, you got to perform at Live Aid in 85 in Philadelphia. I know you've spoken about how amazing that was, an insane crowd and a legendary event. What I'd like to know, though, is do you still own that amazing blue silk waistcoat you was wearing?
Yeah, I wish I did, actually. No, I don't. That was something else, yeah. I mean, I remember getting our clothes from, I think it was definitely New York, and I think it was in Chelsea that we went to this great kind of hippie shop. They had all these great, you know, satin clothes and everything else. And I just picked out that stuff and just ran with it. It suited what we were doing at Live Aid.
That thing should be in a Hard Rock Cafe somewhere now.
Yeah. Funny enough, my snare drum's in a Hard Rock Cafe in London.
Oh, wicked. Which one? The original Hard Rock Cafe?
The original one in London, yeah, Hyde Park.
Oh, brilliant. How long's it been there? Just like forever?
It's been there for quite some time, yeah. They obviously took it and then put it up on the ceiling.
When did the band get to rewatch the Live Aid set? I think it was in the studio at the time.
Yeah, I remember in the studio we watched it back. We were quite peeved because they cut off some of it because they had a feed problem. So they cut off half of our last song. So that was a bit strange. But no, we watched it in the studio and it was great.
You played in so many amazing bands. How was it being a part of Spandau Quo recently?
Spandau Quo, that was funny. That was a real comedy satire. Yeah, they asked me to do it. I wasn't sure what was going on with that situation, but it ended up to be really hilarious in the end. I know the Spandau guys for quite some time. Francis Rossi I'd never met before. He's a lovely guy, complete gentleman. And so it was really funny. David Arnold I knew as well because I played on one of his solo albums.
Is there anybody you've still to check off the list who you'd like to play with or record with?
Oh, many people.
Put it out there, Mel. Let's put it out there.
I'd love to play with Bruno Mars. That'd be great. Who else is there? Earth, Wind & Fire. I don't know. This is pretty much most of them I've played with in some shape or form.
Who would you like to go out on the road with, the new album? Like any acts who you think, yeah, I'd love to open for them or go out on the road with them? Is it like a double bill?
I'd love to go out with this band, with Def Leppard. I think that would be quite a good partnership, yeah.
You know what? That'd be a really good double header, I reckon.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good match.
I think fan base would be like, what's this all about? Where's Def Leppard with another heavy metal band or a hard rock band? But once they saw it, I think it'd make sense to them.
I think so. I think it would be good, yeah.
Def Leppard, it's all about the hooks and melodies and always has been.
Absolutely. And they're very melodic. A very melodic band for a heavy metal band.
Mel, I'll let you go because I don't want to keep you too long, but I appreciate you chatting with me. I wish you all the best for the album. I look forward to hearing it when it's out.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. Take care.
Big shout and thank you to Mel Gaynor for joining me on today's Straight to Video podcast. Mel and I only had a brief time to chat, but what a career. I'd love to deep dive a little more sometime as I'm sure there's some incredible stories and experiences which he could share. The new single Run is out now on all digital platforms, followed by the full-length album Come With Me, released by Marquee Records on May the 3rd. Over at our 80s video shop in Alfreton, Derbyshire, just 10 minutes from Junction 28 of the M1, we're having some screenings of our film, One Night Rental, this coming weekend on the 16th and 17th of March. So this is a chance to watch the film in the location it was actually filmed. So if you want to come along, head on over to www.80svideoshop.co.uk to pick up some tickets. There are going to be two screenings each day at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. And for £15, you can pick up a ticket DVD bundle, which gets you to watch the film, but also take home a copy on DVD. So that's all for this week's podcast. I want to thank you all for continuing to listen each week, and I'll be back for a brand new episode next Friday. So until then, make sure to always be kind. Please rewind and unwind, and I'll speak to you all real soon.